Hello and welcome to GabFest Reads for August 2022. It's the Invisible Things edition. I'm David Plotz of CityCast. I'm in Washington, D.C., and I am joined today on GabFest Reads by Matt Johnson. Matt and I are going to talk about his wild, strange, and very funny new novel, Invisible Things. Matt is the Knight Chair of Humanities at the University of Oregon, and he's the author of books of nonfiction, graphic novels, and novels, including Pym and Loving Day, Loving Day being an Emily Bazelon favorite. Matt, welcome to GabFest Reads. Congratulations on Invisible Things.
Hey, nice to meet you.
So Invisible Things is an allegorical novel about New Roanoke, a city inside a bubble located on a moon of Jupiter. A U.S. spaceship discovers New Roanoke, which turns out to be a pleasant facsimile of an American city, complete with all the fast food outlets of the home planet, but populated entirely by people who were inexplicably kidnapped from Earth and woke up on New Roanoke. New Roanoke has a governing party. It has a Fox-like TV network. It has lots of economic inequality and is sustained by shipments of goods that appear to come from nowhere. The story of Invisible Things is about the tumult unleashed when a pair of American spaceships and their crews arrive at New Roanoke and what happens then. And it's an extremely funny and political and ominous kind of book, more so even than my brief summary suggests. So Matt, first of all, it reminded me, as I'm sure it will remind everyone who reads it, of a book I have not read since high school, which is Gulliver's Travels. Was that an inspiration for this book?
Yes, and also completely inadvertently. Like, a lot of times when I'm done is when I look and see the DNA, you know, of certain books. And things like Gulliver's Travel has such a massive impact on so many books that it's not just, you know, the original, but that the entire way we frame the conversation ends up coming to that. Like, originally, the last two books I wrote about monsters under the ice in Antarctica. And, you know, I'd originally been inspired by the first movie I ever saw alone, John Carpenter's The Thing. And I didn't know until after that that John Carpenter's The Thing was inspired, you know, a couple steps away through Lovecraft and then to Poe, to Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym in the Antarctica. So, you know, as somebody who actually teaches early American lit sometimes, these things are really genetically, like, in the literature, like how we think about framing things. And so when it was done, I looked and like, oh, yeah, that makes complete sense, you know. But at the time, it wasn't like a conscious thing.
There are lots of great inventions in this book, but the really great invention is this idea that they're on the moon Europa, just off the coast of Jupiter, is a city that is extremely like an American city. Where did this idea of a bubble city eerily like our own come from? What were you seeing in the world around you that made you, you know, think, oh, here's an allegory for me?
All these things come in from a lot of different places. So it's like, sometimes it's look back and it looks like it comes from one place or it comes from another. But I think the original impetus was that every time we have a conversation about what's happening in America, in our country, or in Britain, or France, or all of us that are going through very similar cultural moments, not identical, but very similar, that as soon as you say like two words, people get an idea of where you're coming from. They understand your initial prejudices, what news sources you're accessing, all these things. So it's really incredibly difficult to have a conversation that hasn't already become stale before you hit the third word, right? And so initially, I was looking, you know, at what was happening in the States, what was happening with Brexit, and I was wanting to have a conversation that wasn't here, you know, that was someplace else and removed it. I think I found I couldn't separate it as much as I wanted to because it was just too specific to this moment. But I did want to take it someplace else where at least I could get five words into the sentence before people would have these set things. And also, like, I look at novels the same way our brain uses dreams, right? In dreams, nothing actually happened. And the people in our dreams don't act like they actually do in real life. And the places we go in our dreams are kind of collages of places we know. And the reason we do that, the reason our mind does that, is it allows us just enough distance to be able to examine situations without the, you know, being stuck in the same loops and in the same prejudices, and also have some emotional distance, right? Almost like, you know, I teach mouse sometimes, and Art Spiegelman's mouse, and just the slight difference of having, you know, mice and cats and dogs has this massive impact on how you can emotionally deal with the text. And so I looked at it like that. And also with, along with that, I went into it kind of like I went into dreams where I didn't know where we were going to go. The central metaphor of the book, The Invisible Things, didn't come until I think the second draft of the book, you know, because that, having that distance was enough to let me find things that I couldn't necessarily do in my conscious mind.
Right. And the central metaphor, just for our listeners, is this idea that there are forces that act on people on this planet that are invisible, and no one will talk about it. And the mirror, and it's a shibboleth. You cannot talk about it, and talking about it endangers you. And no one will be around you. There's so many allegories. This is about race. It is about climate change. It's about politics. It's about inequality. All of which are sort of major themes of this book, and all of which you could argue are invisible things of our world. Right.
Right. Yeah, I think like one of the frustrating things as a satirist was that we are living in a satire, right? And like the essence of satire is you take reality and you ratchet it up to extreme, and then we can see the absurdity of it. But we live in an absurd reality, you know? And so like, I always like thought there should have been a, you know, a bailout of satirists at some point, because it's so difficult to function the way we used to function. So what I tried to do instead was, instead of getting caught in the weeds on climate, or caught in the weeds on race, on misogyny, all these things, like, I think I've become more interested in the overall way that we as individuals and as a society function, the way we store and negotiate information that ends up having us deal with these situations in almost identical ways. And, you know, like, I think for having a bigger target allows so much more to come in. Because again, if I was thinking just with race or with climate, and it's certainly part of the thinking, but then I wouldn't have been able to see how this applies to other things, right? And how this way of not acknowledging directly reality, because it's, you know, it's difficult to deal with, it's possibly fruitless and pointless and not worth the effort of dealing with it, but also where we end up going because of that. And then the cycles of it. And, you know, I wrote this before the pandemic primarily. And a lot of the things that I wrote about ended up playing out in some ways over the last couple of years. And I think that was because I was just looking at the bigger ways we deal with stuff.
I love the idea of the satire bailout, by the way. There's shows like, you can't watch Veep. Veep is unwatchable now, which was a funny show. Or the movie Idiocracy, which just now seems like a documentary. There is this idea running through it that, you know, we will not look at the things that are too difficult. I don't like to look at the things that are too difficult. Are you somebody who actually goes around and is like, I really want to face up to the hard realities of the world around me? Because I sure the fuck don't.
The initial impetus of the book was immediately the first horrific year of the Trump administration. I was online, like on Twitter, and everybody I know was on Twitter, and everyone's just like screaming, like, ah! You know, like every day, the worst thing in the world was happening. I was still in my screaming on Twitter phase. And I would go, I'd be on Twitter all day, you know, inadvertently. And then I would go to the coffee shop, and I would see, I was living in Houston at the time and teaching at the University of Houston. And there was a main coffee shop that a lot of the department would go to. And so I go in, I'd see all these people who had also been screaming online for months. And I'd run into them and they'd be like, hey, how's it going? Oh, fine. How you doing? Good, good. Hey, huh? Okay, good. And then that was it, right? Because there was nothing to talk about, right? We both shared the same reality. We both knew what was happening. There was no, we were trying to relax. There was no benefit to it. And if we didn't share the same reality, there was nowhere to go in that conversation, because right now, like, we aren't arguing over facts. We're arguing over realities, right? And we have a large segment of population that has been unmoored, you know, from reality. So there's no way you can win an argument with somebody that where facts don't matter, right? So ultimately what I found was we just weren't talking about things because there just wasn't much to do. And the ones who were talking about it just sounded crazy. You know, Mueller's going to come and he's going to save us all. And, you know, like it was this like crazy theories because, you know, at the time it felt like there was nothing we could do. Now, looking back, if I could go back, there was things I would tell, you know, the past version of myself to do, like we need to worry about the elections next time. And we need to worry about these attempts to kind of overthrow democracy, of which there was tons of signs early. But it seemed so overwhelming and we were so overwhelmed by what we couldn't do that like it was easy to forget or devalue the little things that turns out to be essential.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
You're so good on power and co-optation and how people sort of join systems and get co-opted by systems. And the crew of this, one of the crews of this ship that ends up on New Roanoke has a leader who's just a guy who always makes his way in institutions. And he recognizes that he can become a leader on New Roanoke by being a sycophantic newcomer, and that the sycophantic newcomer who tells you, comes to your society and tells you how great your society is and sucks up to you, is somebody who's always really welcome. Even if, in fact, life for a newcomer is terrible, life for an immigrant is terrible, if the person who comes and says, oh, this is so great, oh, I'm so glad to be part of it, that person is really welcomed by the ruling class, which is it's a phenomenon that we see all over our world.
Yeah, I mean, coming, like, I'm mixed, with African-American mixed, and coming from the Black American world, if you are a mediocre person, but you want to do really well in as a public intellectual, then all you have to do is supplant yourself, you know, to the people who would otherwise destroy you. the door is always open. You know, it's not like a surprise that people, you know, like Herman Cain, were able to do so well within the Republican Party. Herman Cain would have made it out of the door on the Democratic side because it would have been far more competition that he wouldn't have been able to stand up to. And so you see that again and again. It's also it's kind of scary too, because then you also have to ask yourself, you know, why am I being accepted here? Why are they want me to say what I'm saying? Particularly if what you're doing is contrary to the mainstream of your individual group. You know, even like as a professor, like I work in a very, very sort of, I didn't even know. It's so, it's almost like a serfdom system. We have people like myself who teach relatively small amounts of courses and get paid a lot of money. And then you have a serf class of adjunct professors who teach endless classes for almost no money. Some of them, people living in their cars. Like, you know, I'm very happy. One of the reasons I wanted to come to Oregon was because it had a union, which my last institution didn't have. How am I getting pulled into that system? How am I getting pulled into other systems? You know, I think that is still always one of the trickiest things. And it's also frustrating when you're on the other side of it and you see everybody in, you know, all team blue is saying we should do this. And they find one, like, you know, half awake guy in the corner is like, we should do the opposite. And that's the guy they pull out to listen to. So you just see it kind of again and again.
I want to go back to this question about the invisible things and the people of New Roanoke just refuse to look at all these forces around them, the inequality around them, and the force that brought them to New Roanoke, which they don't understand. Is it better to look at these things or not better to look at these things?
Ultimately, I don't think we have a choice. You know, one of the weird moments during the pandemic that reminded me of something that was already in the book was the Black Lives Matter initial explosion of protesting in the street, which is very similar to, you know, where the book goes. And like, it was a reminder that, like, the question is not whether you're going to deal with it. The question is how you're going to deal with it, right? It's just like, you know, if you have medical symptoms of a problem, you can ignore that. It's easier to ignore it, but eventually you're going to have to deal with it. And so much of how we're living in our society right now, in American society in particular, has to do with things we really didn't want to deal with that are all hitting the fan at once. And so, like, it's scary to me as an American, as a person who loves so much about this country, watching, you know, as Malcolm X said, chickens come home to roost, and watching, you know, our basic hypocrisies hitting us in the face, you know, again and again. And it does feel like everybody thinks they live in the Armageddon times, but it does feel like our major problems also have to do with our major hypocrisies, you know, as a nation. So for that reason, like, yeah, I mean, we don't have a choice. We have to deal with it. And in fact, like, if something feels uncomfortable, there's probably a good indication that we should be talking about it.
One of your characters describes New Roanoke as having this sort of division where it's 10, 20, 40, 20, 10, sort of, and the bulk of society, the 40% of society, which doesn't, they just kind of want to get along. There's only a small percentage that is so really needs to shake it up and break it. And there's only a small percent that's hugely benefiting from it. And most people are just like, okay, whatever. Let's just keep going.
Yeah, which is obvious, right? Like, the people who are going to be fighting tooth and nail to keep society exactly the way they are the people who are benefiting the most from it. And the people who are going to be complaining the most about it and the most ardent about changing the society, it's usually not because they're particularly good people. It's because they are being adversely, directly affected by what's going on, right? It's not a moral purity. It's the fact that they're getting screwed, right? And so if a society is going to function, then the majority has to be kind of untouched enough that they don't give a shit, you know? In my own family, like, I'm very fortunate, like, as a mixed person who's close to all my family on Irish American side, you know, white side, and African American side. When I talk to some of my family members on that white side, you know, they live in the suburbs. They're really not affected in their minds by anything that's going on. And so when you start to have a conversation about anything kind of veers into that, they go into, well, both sides, right? And while both sides actually translates is, this is not affecting me. So I'm just going to pretend it's not happening. And if things get bad enough that it does, then I'll pay attention at that point, right? So, which is also understandable. I mean, we have busy lives. I mean, I probably didn't miss an episode of the Political Gabfest for like a decade. Really.
Oh my God.
It. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Your voice. Think of how many novels you could have written.
Right. One of the weird things is I realized at one point, like, you know, I'm also a big 76ers fan. It's almost the same, you know, like I'm watching a drama unfold. I know the characters, I know the tragedies, I know the victories. And so it's not simply that I'm trying to be up to date. I'm also watching a soap opera in the same way that you watch soap opera, literally the same way you watch a sports team, right? And so you know all the characters and everything else. But most people don't have that as a hobby, right? And so because they don't have a hobby, they're presented with all this information that's very difficult to decipher. And if you don't know what's going on, it's almost impossible to figure out who's saying what. Like, I was just watching the hearings and seeing the people showing up to protest at the different state officials' houses to get them to overturn the election. And when you hear what they're saying, they're like, you are a traitor. You are defiling the Constitution. They're yelling all these things that are projection. You know, that, oh, I don't even know if there's projection because that implies a subconscious effort, but they're yelling things that they are guilty of, right? And so if you are not in that world, it's like, it's confusing, it's annoying. And if you don't have to deal with it, you've got a million other things to deal with and you're not going to be thinking about it. But, you know, unfortunately, that group of kind of complacent people, understandably complacent people, end up basically being unconscious supporters of the status quo. And for that reason, you know, it's almost impossible to move things around because everything doesn't really matter what, at this point, one party does. It's both sides, right? So it doesn't matter if one party, you know, stubs a toe and the other party gets its leg chopped off. It's both sides, right? They both have difficulty with that. And, you know, and the media, of course, plays into that. I think, too, as Americans, we have been privileged with the idea that we really don't have to pay attention to what's going on. We're going to be fine. And this is particularly white Americans, white middle-class Americans. That, you know, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, I'm going to be fine. It doesn't matter. Now, for me, on my black side, I'm watching the news going, like, I'm watching Trump going, like, am I going to get killed? Like, is my family, are my kids going to be okay walking down the street? He's inciting hate. That is directly affecting my life. Is my son going to get shot coming back from school, right? So I'm much more focused on it. But yeah, I think it's just a natural way that we end up grouping.
So I did not know when I read this book, because I had not read other books by you, that you also write graphic novels. And I want to say, and this is a high praise indeed, it reads like a graphic novel. Like, it is a very visual novel. You paint a picture of this city and this world that is visually pleasing and active, and it's like full of visual life as a book.
Yeah, I have no sense of smell. I haven't smelled anything since 1997, I think. And I think because of that, I think it actually, for years, I was like, why does my work tend to be more visual? And I think that's why, is that my smell's non-existent. My hearing isn't particularly great. So things visually have this massive impact for me. And I started by reading comics. I wouldn't read books when I was little. I read comics from like 6 to about 11. And the only reason I think I switched to books was that I was embarrassed to read comic books, like, you know, in public. At the time, I probably wouldn't be at 11 today. And then the other part of it was financial. Like in Philly, at 30th Street, at Reading Terminal Station in Philly, there was a used bookstore. And they had sci-fi books in there for like 50 cents. You know, used, beat up old Heinlein, you know, Roger Zelazny, books like that. And I realized, well, if for 50 cents, I could buy one comic that I can read in 20 minutes, or I can buy this novel that I could read for, you know, a week or 2 weeks. And that got the addiction going. But I think it's still like just part of like how I look at the world.
What's the science fiction you love?
I think growing up, I was, Roger Zelazny was like a huge one. I can't read it now because the misogyny is so thick in a lot of it that it's just like, you know, once you see it, you know. But my mother had a bunch of science fiction books around the house that I used to read, and Ray Bradbury and Heinlein, that golden age of early sci-fi. And then I think when I started moving towards literary fiction, it wasn't in this urge to read serious fiction. It was an urge to read better sci-fi and fantasy. And, you know, the way I got the first big book of literary fiction I got into was Beloved, because it was a ghost story. You know, and I was interested in a ghost story. And then I got interested in Vonnegut, you know, because it had those elements in it, the elements of fantastic, which I really loved. And that kind of opened up this whole other wide range. But I think myself and a lot of people of my kind of Gen X generation were heavily influenced by genre writing and also in some ways reacting into a type of realism of depressed upper middle class white people that, you know, the New Yorker realism. Many of the books, stories in that vein I love, but I wanted something more and I needed something more to kind of break open the page in a way that realism really couldn't do.
What is the deal with bubble cities? Yours is the third novel I've read in the last year that has a bubble city in it. No, Sea of Tranquility. The Emily St. John Mandel book is another bubble city book.
I think when you're talking about the fact that like things just show up in this place in New Roanoke, at the beginning, it just felt like a strategic things to build this reality. And then I look back at it and I'm like, oh yeah, I live in a world where things just show up on boats. I have no idea where they come from. I mean, in Portland, we have all these, you know, tankers coming in with Amazon products that I have no idea where they come from. So it's very real. And that bubble is obviously very real. And when I lived in Texas for 12 years, and I think it was the first time I met people that were functionally living in an information bubble that was disassociated from reality. And that was just kind of shocking. It's still shocking to me. I wake up some days and I think, like, if we didn't have Rupert Murdoch and nobody else, it was the other one stepped in, and we also didn't have a vastly disproportionate Senate, where would we be right now? But we do. And so we have these kind of bubble realities that we try and equate and say they're all the same, but they're not. Some of them are really hardcore. So yeah, I think like the bubbles don't even feel like really a metaphor. It just feels like how we're actually living.
As you were talking about the ships, it's so true that who knows where it all comes from? Who knows what the supply chain is? Like it all could be just conjured up off the Pacific coast. It just magically appears there for all we know.
If I had to explain it, that's probably what I would say.
Matt Johnson's very funny, very provocative, deeply enjoyable book is Invisible Things, a new novel. It's out now. Thanks for coming on Gabfest Reads, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
That's Gabfest Reads for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shayna Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the Executive Producer of Slate Podcasts. Please follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest and tweet chatter, your chatter to us there. Maybe what book you'd like us to read on Gabfest Reads. I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you again on Thursday.